Hi there, everybody. Welcome to this seminar. We have an enormous number of people who've come on to this, which I think tells us a lot, both about the topic, which is very actual, and I think I'm bound to say about the quality of our speakers. We've got a great lineup tonight, and I'm sure we're going to have some great questions from you. Let me just say who I am first. My name is Professor Michael Cox, or Mick Cox, as I sometimes prefer to be called. I work very closely with Arnie Westad, who's here tonight, who's now at Yale, used to be at the LSE. We actually established a Cold War Center back in 2004, which went on to become LSE Ideas. The speakers in order for this evening are going to be, we're going to start with Arnie Westad from Yale, who's going to give us some reflections as to whether he thinks it is a Cold War, but maybe extend and enlarge the debate beyond the narrow question of is it or is it not a Cold War, to what he thinks the state of the relationship actually is. We're then moving to Jacob Helberg. Very welcome, Jacob, from Stanford, a senior advisor at the Stanford University Cyber Center and co-chair of the Brookings Institution China Strategy Working Group. Jacob, thank you very much for being here this evening, joining us here at LSE Ideas. Our third speaker needs no introduction to me, and I'm sure for many of you out there, Professor Christopher Coker of the International Relations Department, now director of LSE Ideas. Christopher, wonderful to have you here. Chris will bring his own particular and specific reflections on the relationship. And last but by no means least, we're going to welcome Oriana Skila Mastro, a Center Fellow at the Freeman Spohley Institute for International Studies at Stanford. Oriana, wonderful to have you here this evening. I'm going to say a few words by way of introduction, just to let everybody know we will have a 1.5 hour session tonight, so we've got plenty of time. The speakers will all try and speak within the 7 minutes allotted to them. So that's enough time at least to get the conversation going before we get on to what I think will be the most, maybe not the only interesting part, but certainly a very interesting part of the evening, the questions and answers. We're going to get lots of those because we've now already got nearly 350 people who have signed up tonight. Can I just say a couple of words by way of introduction, not to try and answer the question, is it a Cold War or not, but simply to say where, and I said this earlier on, when Arnie Westad and I got together years back, many years back, we put together a Cold War Study Center here at the LSE. There were two reasons for doing that. One, because we were both very interested in the Cold War and written about it in different ways. But secondly, we wanted to ask a question then, which I think we still haven't got the answer to, Arnie. What have been the long-term consequences on the international system after the Cold War, as we once understood it, and the end of the Cold War? What have been the impacts of that long 50-year, 45-year period on the international system today? Now, we all thought the Cold War had come to an end. But now people are now telling me it never really went away. So in a way, this is a very appropriate discussion for having it here this evening with Arnie and myself and our great colleagues from across in the United States. Did it ever go away? What is it we now call it? Is the word itself, the term new Cold War, really a kind of a shortcut for sloppy thinking? Or is it basically, we are seeing a repetition of the past? If we're not seeing a repetition of the past, then what do we call the current state of the relationship between the US and China? So with no further ado, I'm going to call on Arnie Westad to kick off the debate for 7 minutes. Arnie, if you don't mind, move on to Jacob, then on to Christopher and Oriana to conclude. So Arnie, we're waiting in anticipation. Arnie, over to you.
Fantastic, Mick. It's great to be back at LSE, though only virtually so far. I hope we can remedy that fairly soon. I'm really missing my old haunts and my old comrades around Lincoln's Inn Fields. It's something that I hope we can do to see more of each other very soon. So I'll be brief. So the way I understand the question today is whether this is a new Cold War, the relationship between the United States and China. And there is a great deal of conceptual confusion that's gone into attempting to answer that question, because we have in reality tried to look at it through two different lenses. So the first way of looking at the question is, of course, asking the question using the Cold War as a kind of simile for conflict or even intense conflict, meaning that answering the question means answering the question of whether there is now an intense conflict between the United States and China that is going to be systemic, that is going to be durable. And my answer to that is clearly yes. So if you use the term Cold War as a kind of catch-all for all kinds of intense conflict, I have no trouble with using it. The problem with that is that it's conceptually, and particularly in research terms, very fuzzy. It doesn't really answer some of the questions that we should be asking about similarities and differences between this conflict and the last great international system, what we learned to call the Cold War, between the United States and the Soviet Union, and by extension between capitalism and socialism on an international scale. So no surprise to people at LSE, I'm going to concentrate on the latter interpretation of the question. What are the similarities and differences between that conflict and what we are now seeing developing between the United States and China? Neither will it be a great surprise that I have found similarities and differences. I mean, these are laid out for those who want to explore them a bit further in an article I wrote for Foreign Affairs last year, exactly a year ago now. But just very briefly for the sake of discussion today, similarities first. So one similarity, obviously, is that China is run by a communist party. The Soviet Union was run by a communist party. I think we need to take communism in China seriously as an ideology. It doesn't mean the same thing as it did in the Soviet Union prior to 1991. But China is run by a communist party, and that does mean something ideologically. That's a similarity with the Cold War. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, China is, in my view, seeking predominance in Asia, very much in a similar way to how the Soviet Union sought predominance in Europe after the Second World War. It might be a different kind of predominance. It might be a search that goes on through slightly different means, but it is still a challenge to the established powers and a challenge to international peace. Then thirdly, both China today and the Soviet Union prior to 1991 saw the United States as its main enemy, not as a rival, not as a potential partner, but as an enemy. And it's very hard not to grasp that if you listen to what Chinese leaders now say about the United States, or for that matter, what American leaders say about China. But from the Chinese perspective, just listen to President Xi Jinping's, General Secretary Xi Jinping's speech the other day on the 70th anniversary of the Korean War. And then finally, in terms of similarities, the United States is still the most significant global power, the way it was during the Cold War, and it's been since the Cold War ended, and I think for some significant period into the future. So the US centrism is still there. It's a different kind now from what was the case during the Cold War, but it is still around, often underestimated, in my view, in terms of its significance, particularly under the current US administration. So those were four similarities. Let me then move on to differences. There are slightly more differences, in my view. I see the current conflict between the United States and China as being more different from the Cold War than similar to the Cold War. So let's look at the differences. The CCP, the party that rules China, in spite of having its origin in communism, is nationalist much more than internationalist. It's preoccupied with getting the most for China out of the international system rather than trying to present an alternative international system like the Soviet internationalist strategy did. Secondly, in terms of differences, China is very much part of a global market economy. And I'm not saying that in order to say that countries, states that are highly interactive economically do not necessarily go to war against each other. I think that argument has been laid to rest. But it's just that it's a very significant difference between China today and the Soviet Union of old. The Soviet Union very much self-isolated from the global market economy because, as I've already said, it wanted to present a non-capitalist alternative. Then thirdly, and this is, I think, really important, Chinese society, if you look at the country from within, is very much driven by market ideals and by ideals in general in terms of betterment and individual advance that are not all that different from what you find in the United States. As a European, I often make this joke both when I'm here in America and in the United States and in China, that I feel rather old-fashioned as a European who believe in some degree of collective values, both when I'm in China and when I'm in the United States. There are, as I said in my foreign affairs piece, there are many more similarities than differences between Chinese society and US society today. That was not the case during the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. Fourthly, there is a difference in terms of the historical era that we are living in a broad sense. The Soviet Union was exhausted after the First World War, and therefore much less prone to engage in active, broad, large-scale conflict of a military kind with the United States. China has had peace for a very long time. This is a difference that comes out more as a negative difference, and again, I explore it further in the foreign affairs piece. It's not something that means that the relationship today between China and the United States is going to be more peaceful than what it was between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War. It rather means the opposite, as we have seen in other cases, if you compare it in a longer period of historical time between countries that are exhausted from war and those where particularly the younger population, as in China, might see war, at least limited war, as a solution to some of their problems. And then finally, in my view overall, and this is a major difference, in spite of the United States remaining the most significant global power, the trend on a global scale is not towards bipolarity between the United States and China, the way the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union was bipolar. In my view, the world is moving much more in the direction of multipolarity, with several important regional powers increasing their power, relatively speaking, both with regard to the United States, but also with regard to China. Think about India in South Asia. Think about what has happened more recently in terms of developments elsewhere in Europe, in Latin America. So I don't think we're heading towards more bipolarity, rather towards more multipolarity. So just to conclude, Mick, my view is that the best way of understanding, and I say this with regret in many ways, the best way of understanding the situation that we seem to be heading towards now is not as a new Cold War. It is rather a world that to me looks strikingly and sometimes frighteningly similar to the world towards the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, before World War I. Multipolarity, intense nationalism, conflict over resources and trade and markets. So I'm sorry to disappoint people who thought that when I say this is not a new Cold War, that's all good news. It isn't. And for that reason, and for other reasons, I think it's important that we think this through, particularly those of us who do this as a job, figuring out how we can learn from history in a broad sense in terms of managing the conflicts that we're looking at today.
Okay, Arne, I think you've set that up brilliantly well, as always. But end on a pessimistic note. So even if it's not a new Cold War, as people often understand it, doesn't mean to say it's going to be a nicer world. It's going to be a more difficult, maybe more dangerous world. You even do the analogy with the 20-year period before 1914, which is a very worrying analogy indeed. Jacob, over to you, and look forward to what you have to say. Thank you very much, Arne.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. I hope that someday in the not too distant future, we'll be able to all meet in person at LSE. We're having this debate today because after so many years of attempts at engagement, often without adequate consideration of long-term effects, we're now watching China vying with the United States for global leadership. And that's something that people and democracies around the world increasingly understand. By a margin of over two-thirds, people across the United States, France, the UK, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and Germany now view China unfavorably. And the reason is simple. It's the CCP's deepening authoritarianism, expansionism, and revisionism. The question today, in my view, is not about whether we are reliving the Cold War. The question today is whether we are living through a Cold War. The term Cold War has a history. In fact, George Orwell helped define it. He called it a prolonged peace that is no peace. 600 years ago, before Orwell, the Spanish scholar Don Juan Manuel articulated the idea of a tepid war, simmering below the thin surface of peace. In most people's understanding of plain English, the United States and China are not in an authentic peace. At the end of the day, China's endgame is, as members of the EU say, systemically incompatible with the United States' vision of a rules-based liberal order. Arnie and I actually agree that, quote, the CCP sees Washington as an obstacle to its goals of preserving its own rule and gaining regional dominance. Ariana and I actually agree that under Xi, quote, China has unabashedly undermined the US alliance system in Asia. At the outset of this debate, it's important to start by asking ourselves what the purpose of US foreign policy should be. And I would argue that its foremost purpose should be to serve the fundamental interests and values of the people it represents. A peace that's predicated on the US abdicating interests that are core to the lives of American is, as Orwell eloquently defined it, a peace that is no peace. For a lot of foreign policy academics, the US-China Cold War is an interesting debate and a theory. But for millions of Americans, including members of my own family from Ohio, it has been a painstaking reality. Here are the immutable facts. China's unfair trade practices has produced a bilateral trade deficit in goods the size of a G20 economy. In current day dollars, it surpasses the total reparation costs of World War I imposed on Germany under the Treaty of Versailles, which were widely seen as being so punitive that they precipitated the start of World War II. It has meant 2.5 million manufacturing jobs vanishing between 2001 and 2017, and the closure of 66,000 manufacturing facilities. By some accounts, up to 90% of the world's fentanyl compounds are made in China, and they're all for export, most of which to the United States. Meanwhile, the opioid epidemic has killed five times more Americans than the Vietnam War, both Gulf Wars, and the war in Afghanistan combined. Some have called this a third opium war. The FBI now opens a new China-related investigation every 10 hours. The CCP has blocked most American content platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, GitHub, Google, YouTube, Reddit, Netflix, just to name a few. The level of intellectual property theft they've engaged in has been referred to by the former head of Cybercom and the current head of the FBI as, quote, the greatest transfer of wealth in human history, estimated at $3 trillion between 2008 and 2018. Since 2017, the CCP has explicitly sought to export its so-called, quote, China model of authoritarianism to over 18 countries around the globe. And most shockingly to our conscience, China, the world's second largest economy that aspires to lead this world, is engaged in genocide and the largest systematic industrial-scale imprisonment of innocent civilians since the Holocaust. All of this has taken place in the murky gray zone between war and peace, just below the conventional threshold of war. And with the global economy far more integrated than it ever was in 1950, gray zone conflict has actually become a defining trait in international politics, conflict, and competition, particularly in the way that governments advance their interests and weaken their adversaries. That's why I actually prefer to describe the current standoff as a gray war, a slightly more precise modern day adaptation of Orwell's definition of Cold War, where ambiguity and gray zone attacks are the norm rather than the exception. War and peace have never been binary and have always been a spectrum. Just ask the two generals that wrote the book on unrestricted warfare. although the weapons of war have changed, although weaponry has shifted from a conventional contest to a tech-driven asymmetric contest, the underlying geopolitical power dynamics at work remain the same. As a policy advisor at Google, I saw companies across industries with operations in the US and China already struggling to adhere with ideological systems that are fundamentally at odds. When you're trying to comply with one system, which is predicated on total compliance with the CCP, including the surveillance of users and the censorship of speech, and you're also trying to comply with another system that's predicated on the protection of that information, you effectively have two systems that are fundamentally in conflict. China and the United States define political legitimacy in ways that are ideologically contrary, and as China exports abroad its China model of governance, tensions with democracies will inevitably sharpen. US proponents of unconditional engagement with China have too often assumed the CCP would simply mirror their own behavior. They fail to realize that the CCP follows a pattern of behavior that is completely at variance with their own. And as Zbigniew Brzezinski once warned, quote, to appeal for peace while at the same time doing everything to prevent it is a key feature of the relations of a totalitarian dictatorship with the rest of the world. They assumed China would grow freer as it grew richer. They assumed China would buy into the international system rather than seek to replace it. They assumed China would remain focused on being a regional power, and now the Belt and Road Initiative stretches all the way to Scotland. They assumed China's rise would remain peaceful. The CCP is now embarked on a vast military buildup to, quote, fight and win wars, already armed with the world's largest navy of 350 warships. And just this summer, it launched an unprovoked attack that killed 20 Indian soldiers. Making democracies inoffensive to the CCP simply hasn't worked. And today, several governments are grappling with how to best pursue a foreign policy that fulfills the twin objectives of both preserving peace while at the same time preserving the political and economic security of democracies. And pursuing these objectives means reestablishing a strong deterrence led by the United States and democratic allies. As Michel Flournoy astutely observed, quote, the erosion of American deterrence only raises the risk of Chinese miscalculation. Without a strong and credible deterrence, policies of unconditional engagement could actually invite the type of conflict it was meant to avoid in the first place. Proponents of accommodation will sometimes argue that a more muscular policy by saying things like, the world is so complex, the US-China relationship is so complex that our policy approach should therefore be complex, as though complexity means better outcomes. But in Silicon Valley, engineers are trained to know that overly complex systems are in fact far more prone to fail than simpler ones. Simplicity is both more effective and harder than complexity because it means prioritizing what to focus on and communicating in simple terms what the mission is. In Silicon Valley, founders know that if you can't articulate what your core mission is in clear and crisp way to your users, you're far more likely to fail. And these basic ideas hold important lessons in foreign policy. But importantly, a lot of issues in the US-China relationship are not actually that complex. There's nothing complex about genocide and crimes against humanity. And as Vice President Biden has said, silence is complicity. Harkening back to a policy of unconditional engagement will likely once again subject the public to a peace on terms that amount to a strategic defeat without a war. Or as Chinese strategists sometimes put it, allow Beijing to, quote, win without fighting. And it'll further embolden the CCP to engage in behavior that will make the outbreak of war even more likely. In the end, democracies may not be interested in getting involved in a new generational geopolitical contest with China, but the aggressive revisionist worldview of CCP leaders in Beijing is rapidly ensuring that this contest is interested in democracies.
Okay, thanks, Jacob. Two very strong presentations. Anybody who quotes Orwell and Brzezinski together, that might carry the day. We'll have to wait and see for the Q&A, but thank you very much, Jacob. And now I pass over to my colleague, Professor Christopher Coker. Christopher, over to you. Thanks again, Jacob. You're on mute, Christopher.
I think I'm unmute now.
You're okay. Right? You're okay now. You're fine.
Thank you very much.
Go for it.
Jacob mentioned Joe Biden 4 years ago when he was vice president. He talked about relations between the United States and China reaching an inflection point. No one quite knew what he meant by that. But then there was no talk of a Cold War at that stage, but I think we're already in it. So what are the features of the original Cold War? So I would look at similarities, but more of the similarities than the dissimilarities, which he highlighted. And let me just mention three. One is that there was a reference narrative, which is this academic speak for a story. And actually both superpowers told themselves the same story, that capitalism and communism were in crisis, they would be destroyed by their internal contradictions, and that until such time as history delivered its verdict, coexistence, peaceful coexistence was essential. So that was the reference narrative. Power was redefined. We had soft power, I would say, for the first time in history, as well as hard power. So we had the appeal of communism, all those national liberation movements in the 1960s in Africa and elsewhere, and the appeal of the free world, of course, and democracy. But we also had hard power which we'd never seen before in history, nuclear power, deterrence, and an uneasy equilibrium that was constantly challenged by arms races and occasionally shored up by arms control agreements. And then we had a geopolitical struggle, and that struggle was the 20th century, which was the Atlantic century, with Europe as the epicenter of conflict, those 40,000 Russian tanks parked on the border between the two Germanys. So that was basically the original Cold War. Now, as a famous American said, history never repeats itself, but it rhymes, and I would say that it's rhyming now. So what's the reference narrative for the United States and China? It's the liberal world order. What China says is a cover for US imperialism, for the weaponization of the dollar, for secondary sanctions against companies. And the US story, of course, is that China is essentially challenging that world order by using debt entrapment, like the Great Belt and Road Initiative, to subordinate countries. Freedom of navigation is at risk in the South China Seas and perhaps the Indian Ocean. That's the story which both countries are telling themselves, the fate of the liberal world order. What about power? Well, on soft power, China has clearly emerged from the COVID crisis in a much happier position than the United States. It's kind of beaten COVID, if you like, and the United States is now undergoing a third wave. It has Xi Jinping, who is, quite frankly, an improvement any day on Donald Trump. And the United States is a deeply divided society with a broken political system. How broken, we'll see, whether the results of the election will be honored or not. And race riots, some of the worst in American history. But I would also add at this point, the Chinese soft power is also beginning to crumble. Deteriorating relations with countries like India, Australia, Japan. The Asians have woken up to the fact that actually China is going to be like any other great power, basically unpleasant. When I used to go around universities in Singapore and Bangkok and telling people this in 2012, 2013, I was met by disbelief. Yeah. China's not Europe. It's not going to behave like a European great power. Well, I told them it was going to do exactly that. And Xi Jinping has been a disastrous Chinese leader. He's called by Chinese liberals the great accelerationist because he's forcing the pace. He's riding the tiger of nationalism. He's rather like the Kaiser in Imperial Germany in the run-up to the First World War. So I would say that both the soft power of the United States and China is in decline. As one scholar has recently said, the demand for American leadership is in decline across the world, even in Europe. The demand for Chinese leadership is certainly in decline across the world. And it may well be, by the way, that we won't see the United States replaced by China, but this geopolitical model of one great power being replaced by another, Britain by the United States, etc., may be history already. We may see a diffusion, what Arnie referred to as the multipolar system of Europe at the end of the 19th century is, I think, much more likely to be the reality. But the bad news is that as soft power declines for both the United States and China, as they become less interesting for other people, hard power will be ramped up. And in China, we have a new arms race in space, at the sea, in artificial intelligence. We have the American Navy in Battle Force 2048-45, trying to build a 500-ship Navy to deal with China. We have the Chinese adding to their Navy a number of ships every year, is actually the size of the Royal Navy today. And now we get to the key difference, which Arnie highlighted, and the dissimilarities between the two countries in terms of the Cold War, economic relations, because there was no economic interdependence effectively between the United States and the Soviet Union. And today, the United States and China are each other's largest trading partners, as, by the way, Britain and Imperial Germany were in 1913. And that should give us pause for thought. Economic interdependence does not stop wars. I would say, first of all, it doesn't stop trade wars. And so the trade war we've seen between the United States and China is nothing to the trade war that will be coming in future. It hasn't stopped and won't stop the decoupling of economies, which COVID-19 has certainly instigated, you know, the need to reduce your dependence on certain supply chains. It hasn't stopped the formation of new economic blocs against China, like the putative G10, that's the G7, plus South Korea, Australia, and India, or the EU relationship with Asia. And it won't stop possible new US sanctions against China, like ending pension funds investments in China, or restricting future Chinese holdings in US treasury bonds. You know, we haven't seen anything yet. And as far as the geopolitics is concerned, here we have an interesting correlation between, or non-correlation, I should say, between Eurasia, where China has now displaced Russia as the central Eurasian power. Jacob mentions Zbigniew Brzezinski. Brzezinski was, of course, very keen that the United States should be a Eurasian power. It isn't. But what the United States is doing at the moment is an Indo-Pacific future with India, Japan, Australia, and possibly the European Union. So we have a new areas of contestation of power, no longer Europe, but Eurasia and the Indian Ocean. So this is all very dangerous. Both countries want to be great again. And my fear is they will be great at the expense of everyone else. That American nationalism will make the United States more inward-looking, more rancorous, more divided. And then in China, many sinologists say that party elites are becoming more provincial, less cosmopolitan, more nationalistic, and even less technocratic, that the Communist Party itself is changing in China. And we head to what Ian Bremmer, the head of the Eurasia organization, calls a G0 world. That's a world in which there's a global governance gap, because the two greatest powers on the planet will not be able to work together in dealing with a united response to the global challenges that face us, most particularly probably climate change, but also, by the way, pandemics, because the next pandemic is probably only 20 years away. And so it's not a question of whether the Cold War has already begun, because it has. The question is whether the Cold War will go hot. And my prediction, the only one I'm willing to make, is that unfortunately this Cold War, unlike the other, is unlikely to end in one of the two countries' peaceful implosion. Thanks, Mick.
Thank you very much, Christopher. The double decline of two powers, but with the big question at the very end as to whether we talk of Cold War, whether this is going to spill over and become. You wrote this great book, I remember, The Probable Clash. Not inevitable, but I think, you know, you wrote that a little while back, and it seems to me now you've moved a little bit along towards a more pessimistic conclusion. But anyway, Oriana, we now move over to you for the last comments. Very much welcome what you have to say. Hi there. Hi.
Hi, and good morning, everyone. I apologize a bit for the romantic lighting I have over here. It is 6:40 in the morning. I am calling in from Sydney, Australia, where I've been working remotely, even though my appointment at Stanford began in August. This has been a really interesting conversation. It is very rare to me as the military strategist of the group for everyone to be more pessimistic than I am. And so I usually go into these types of talks ready to be accused of all sorts of pessimism and being hawkish, but I actually think that I might be the least pessimistic and least hawkish of this group. So this is gonna be a very interesting discussion. I think Dr. Westad began his talks by asking if the Cold War is a useful analogy. And as someone who focuses on strategy and response, particular, you know, US strategy in my other roles, I think, you know, if we want to refer to the Cold War because it is an example of great power competition, of course, the Cold War was a type of this. It's an example of this. But really, to me, that's where all the parallels end. The form that the competition is taking between China and the United States is completely different. And this is really important to highlight for the sake of how we should respond to it. And in particular, I think the situation is, from the US perspective, more difficult and more dangerous than the Cold War for a number of reasons. And of course, again, given that my background's on military things, I don't disagree with a lot of the comments that were made, for example, by Jacob about the economic challenges, for example, that China presents, but I'll be focusing mainly on the military challenges. First and foremost, it's important to point out that there is a very, very real possibility of a hot war between China and the United States. As other speakers have mentioned, we have the United States and China have incompatible perceptions of their interests in Asia. Right. For the Chinese, they feel they cannot be safe if the US military is allowed to freely operate. Specifically within the First Island Chain, that's where most of our attention is right now. That's the area between China and basically, you know, all of the South China Sea, East China Sea, that kind of area. Now, the United States feels, and have always felt that in order to protect our interests, but also our national security is dependent on the ability to operate freely in the world. And I really liked this idea of Dr. Coker mentioned about reference narratives. I'm not a historian, so I've never heard that. To me, these are just like the true things that we tell ourselves. But reference narratives is very important because I think from the US perspective, it is fundamentally believed that if the US military is hindered in its operations, we cannot protect the homeland. Like that, those two things are connected. And I think maybe it comes from World War II. You know, if the United States cannot quickly respond to crises around the world, we're gonna find ourselves in another World War II type of mentality. So the defining feature, I think, of the Cold War in the military space was that the military competition was not direct. And also that the tools that both the United States and the Soviet Union used were foreign military intervention and proxy wars. China has no interest, and if you read Chinese strategists, on those tools of military power. Now, we talked, you know, some of the speakers talked about China, you know, having global ambitions. In my view, of course, they want to have influence, but militarily, they just want to be able to dominate Asia. And of course, the contours of what Asia is have expanded. I would say 20 years ago, that was just East Asia. You know, the competition was mainly around South Korea, Japan, then it extended down to the South China Sea. Now we're talking about Central Asia as well. But it isn't, the Chinese don't have a view that they want to be able to, project military power to the same degree that the United States does globally, and that they will use that military power in an offensive way as a primary tool of their foreign policy, largely because they see it as ineffective and very costly, and better to use political and economic tools to get what you want. So I think the hot war issue and how military tools are being used is very important. It's also that people always bring up, and it hasn't been brought up yet today, but the nuclear balance. The United States and China do not enjoy what we call MAD, mutually assured destruction. The view was that the Soviet Union and China and the United States could never fight each other because there's this possibility it could escalate to the nuclear level. And there was nuclear deterrence at that level because both sides had equal ability to destroy the other side. Now China, and I think very reasonably so, has always pursued a different nuclear doctrine in which they have a limited minimal deterrent design just to deter the use of nuclear weapons. So I have many scholars say to me, you know, deterrence, as we know from Thomas Schelling, you know, it's about what is unacceptable damage to the other side. And China's view is they can already, you know, leverage unacceptable damage against the United States. That's going to be enough of a deterrent. But I will tell you that neither of the militaries of the United States or China are deterred by the fact that the other have nuclear weapons. Both sides are actively, you know, thinking about preparing for conventional conflicts with one another. And both believe that these conflicts can stay well below the nuclear level. And so maybe they're wrong, but I think that type of mentality is shaping how they're approaching each other. Also, credibility of deterrence is much more difficult. So because what we were facing with the Soviet Union was mainly land wars, we could do things like set up tripwires, like put US troops along the border. And this still, you know, is the strategy and can work in the Korea contingencies, for example, because that would be a land war. Most of the wars we would potentially fight with China are air and naval and orientation. You cannot set up a tripwire, right? Because the space, for example, think about the South China Sea. It's the size of the continental United States. There's always a way that China doesn't have to directly engage US forces to achieve its goal. There's always going to be an independent decision on the part of the United States whether or not to get involved, right? So this creates more difficulty in signaling the credibility of US resolve to actually fight a war. Two, deterring China is much more difficult than deterring the Soviet Union, because the United States, and I don't think we should, but the United States has not conceded a sphere of influence. Imagine if during the Cold War, the United States' position was to deter the Soviet Union before it became the Soviet Union, that Russia could only be Russian, all the former Soviet states were not allowed to be a part of it. And our strategy was to make sure that Russia didn't become the Soviet Union. Imagine how much more difficult that would have been. That's kind of what we're trying to do with China. You know, China has this view that certain territories have always been a part of China. And what we're saying is, no, China, you can't, you know, have those. Now, my viewpoint is that if the United States conceded South China Sea, East China Sea, Taiwan to China, that would be the end of it. I don't believe in this expansionist view that, like, oh, then they're going to want, you know, then tomorrow they're going to want Japan. No, I think that's all they want. The problem is it's too much. You know, and so I agree with Jacob, like, we shouldn't concede that, but it's not because then they'll want more, it's because already that's too much of a threat to US interests. But the problem is we're trying to basically deter them from, you know, achieving these unfulfilled ambitions that lie at the core of who they think they are, which is very difficult. Third, this competition is mainly regional. It's not global. We define our interests in the region, as I said, that make it so we're going to have increased competition. Tension is unavoidable. Of course, China is becoming more and more of a global player. But again, on the military side, I think one of the problems with using the Cold War analogy is we think that the tools and the responses should be the same. And so the United States, you know, or other countries might be preparing, oh, we'll counter China in Africa, we'll counter China in the Middle East. And I think what it does is, you know, it does not help us counter China in Asia. Right. China, this is sort of the fourth point of why it's more difficult. China has more resources than the USSR did. I forget the exact statistics, but I was testifying for Congress recently, and one of my, you know, colleagues brought this up, that, you know, the size of the Chinese economy, you know, compared to the US economy, and then the size of the Soviet economy compared to the US economy, right? The Soviet Union had, you know, half the size of the US economy. And at that time, the United States spent something like, you know, 8% of its GDP on defense. And now we're spending, you know, closer to 3-4%. So the United States has less resources, relative resources, compared to its competitor China, and we're spending less on defense than we used to. And history happened, right? So again, we can't use the same strategies. China learned those lessons. It's not like we're gonna trick China into spending too much on its military so it's gonna internally collapse. Like, we did that once, and it's not gonna work the second time. China also has much more legitimacy than the Soviet Union did. Now, again, with the reference narratives, you know, what we tell ourselves, I wonder how much of these critiques that we have currently levied against China are part of the narrative we've told ourselves, because I am very concerned that actually not everyone agrees that China, that China is a threat to the order. Not everyone agrees that there is an order. I think the United States and maybe some of our allies and partners believe that there's a strong consensus around certain norms and ideas that do not exist, actually. You know, maritime freedom of navigation is one of those. The United States has a very strong position of freedom of navigation that, for example, military vessels constitute peaceful passage. But many countries disagree, not only China, but also, you know, other big countries like India, for example. So I worry that we, you know, we assume that we are right. China is wrong. China has no legitimacy. So we don't have to work at building our legitimacy in terms of our positions. I'll also just note that, you know, a lot of the norms that we think are absolute, like, of course, it has to be this way. If you think about it, there's no reason they actually have to be that way. You know, why is it the case that it's okay to sell weapons to a country if they're going to kill people in other countries, but not okay to sell weapons to a country if they're going to kill people within their country? You know, this is just one example of the differing norms that we have with China. Or why is it okay to infiltrate your spies through your embassy, but not okay to infiltrate your spies as students or journalists? Now, again, I'm not saying that the Chinese way is correct, but I think we have these assumptions that everyone sees it the way we do, and then we don't actually build strategies designed to counter China. Sort of the last point when it was asked, sort of, what should countries do? The UK, Europe, Japan. My biggest fear about using this Cold War mentality is that we are just thinking about these alliances and these relationships in the same old way. We think if we just do more of the same, that's gonna work. But, you know, I wrote in a foreign affairs article last year, you know, China builds and exercises power very differently. And so China is not going to militarily attack and invade Japan, for example. So if the alliance is based on, or even Australia, whatever, you know, Hugh White might be concerned about. So if the alliances are based on deterring military attack, they're successful. But I think what we want today is also to deter forms of coercion. We want to build resiliency. We want to have more autonomy. All of us do, and all these nations around the world want to have more autonomy in their foreign policies beyond military attack. And what this means is we have to rethink what alliances are about. You know, maybe we should respond together to economic coercion just as strongly as we respond to military coercion. And one of the issues with the United States in this competition with China is we are asking more of countries than China does, right? We ask countries in certain scenarios to fight with us. China just asks them not to say certain stuff about Hong Kong or the Uyghurs or Taiwan, right? So again, in this, when the United States and the Soviet Union were competing for influence around the world, you know, other countries, whether, you know, you're outside the region, you're in Africa, you're in Europe, you're, you know, Middle East, you're outside of just Asia and the United States is asking you to pay real costs. In many cases, we're also asking, can you change your whole economic system, your whole political system while you're at it? China is just saying to some African leader, like, don't make this comment about Hong Kong. And they're like, well, I don't care about Hong Kong. Like, okay, sure. You know, so it's actually much harder for the United States in many cases when China isn't planning to directly attack most countries militarily, to have the security guarantee be sufficient to overcome the economic and political benefits that China offers. And also that countries don't have to deal with the economic and political costs that the United States imposes. So I think I'll just conclude by saying, if we use the Cold War analogy, we think that things are the same and we start thinking about strategies and responses in the same way. We think, you know, the West has this legitimacy. Everyone agrees that it would be better off with, you know, the United States in charge. But I think, you know, Dr. Coker mentioned some of the problems existing right now in the United States. I mean, I think that there are a lot of countries that say, okay, United States uses, you know, coerces us just as much as China does. And so it's really important for us to not only have these narratives that we tell ourselves about how we're different than China, but also be different than China across the board and think more in an innovative and entrepreneurial way beyond what we did in the Cold War. What we're going to have to do now to handle the challenge of a rising China and maintain peace and protect the interests of the United States and all of our allies and partners is going to be fundamentally different. So for that reason, I think we should get rid of this concept that we are in another Cold War and try to think about the situation in a fundamentally different way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Oriana. And I hope the background noise wasn't a criticism of what you were saying. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Four very different perspectives, I think. We never planned it like this, but like typical LSE ideas, we hope it comes out like this. What I'm going to do, I've got so many questions come through and so many great questions have come through. But I thought before I bring in questions, I'd like each of you in turn for 2 minutes to say something about what each of your panelists has said or pick up on one particular point. So we can have a little bit of debate between the four speakers. So Arnie, why didn't you go first? Anything that you really want to, you know, get you hot under the collar, which have been said by your three panelists, which you'd like to say a little bit about? Arnie, over to you.
No, I think the big question, which I hope we can spend a lot of time talking about for 35 minutes or so we have left, is what are we going to do about this? You know, what are we going to do about the situation where I think all four of us agree that things are not good and they're getting worse, and that there is a real potential building for military clashes, if not an overall military conflict between the United States and China. So that's where I'd like to start from in terms of getting responses from the others. I think there are two things that need to be done. I mean, what worries me, and this is very much the historian speaking, is the speed with which things have been happening during the Trump administration. So, you know, I slightly disagree with my former colleague at Harvard, Graham Allison, about, you know, if you draw historical comparisons, you will find that it's almost impossible or next to impossible for a great power rivalry to end peacefully. But what I do know is that power shifts that happen very quickly are much more likely to end in all-out war than those that take a bit of time. And what the Trump administration's policies in Eastern Asia especially have led to is a power shift that's happening very rapidly to China's advantage. And that worries me. And that's one of the things that I think we need to discuss, particularly with an election coming up in the United States in a week. And the second point has to do with what is happening in economic terms on a global scale, and particularly coming out of, which I hope we will do next year or the following year, the effects of the pandemic. I mean, it seems to me that if the United States and Europe are not capable of rebuilding their economies in a way that really become competitive with what is happening in China, which for reasons that several of the speakers have pointed out, have had a lot of advantages in terms of how they are ruled with regard to dealing with the pandemic, well, then we are all in trouble, right? Because what that will prove to a lot of people around the world is that authoritarianism has something going for it, which the West cannot compete with. So I think that's the two big challenges that we need to look at in practical political terms from how we get from the situation we're in now to something that will look better, maybe first and foremost look better for people in Eastern Asia, but also further afield.
Thanks very much, Charlie. That's great. And Jacob, I just want to get some brief comments from you, responses to anything your panelists have said or anything you want to elaborate on yourself in about 2 or 3 minutes, if you could. Thanks.
I couldn't agree more with the comments that some of the panelists have said, that the means of war and the means of conflict are very different, and that ultimately the way that the United States and other democracies should approach the current geopolitical standoff should evolve and be different than in the past. I do differ a little bit in the notion that China is a peaceful power. After all, it is important to remember that in Korea in 1950, in India in 1962, in Russia in 1969, Vietnam in 1979, and India again in 2020, China was the aggressor of each of these military confrontations. And it currently shares borders with 14 countries, despite being in border disputes with 17 countries. So it has more border disputes with countries that it actually even shares a border with. So I think that it's, and with respect to the things that China asks other countries to do, I think it's fair to say that it does ask countries to do more than just not say mean things about Uyghurs. It threatened European countries to withhold PPE equipment at the beginning of a lethal pandemic because of investigations about information operations going on in Europe. It launched the biggest cyber attack in Australian history simply because Australia dared to question the origins of the coronavirus pandemic, which is something material to scientists being able to conduct the work of finding a remedy to the coronavirus. So I do think it's important for Western democracies, even though people, for demographic reasons, people often tend to feel that the West is somehow in a position of inevitable decline, because ultimately if China's economy grows proportionally to our own, it will inevitably be larger. think it's important for us to not be gripped with such a deep sense of insecurity that we lose confidence in the fact that there are some things in the world that are universal. The yearning to be free is something that I genuinely believe is shared universally by all human beings. And I say that having traveled to places like North Korea, where people making arguments about moral relativism, that it's all relative and human rights are a Western construct, were bureaucrats, North Korean bureaucrats. But if you asked a family or a mother that worried about her son getting arrested, she very much seems to think that her kids deserved basic protections and basic rights of human dignity. So those are just my brief reactions.
Okay, thanks, Jackie. I just want to bring everybody in. Christopher, a few brief comments to the point. Christopher.
I just want to, Meg, I just want to take up 2 points. A number of the panelists have said that China only has regional ambitions, not global ambitions. It does have global ambitions. It wants to change the rules of the road, to quote Robert Gates. It wants to have a different international system within which it, of course, can aspire to become the major Asian power, which it practically is. And the other thing I'd just say about Cold Wars, we shouldn't get absolutely fixated on the idea that we're looking at the US-Soviet war. I mean, in my book, The Improbable War, I said the first Cold War was between Germany and the United Kingdom from the 1890s on to 1913. And I did that because I was impressed by George Lisker, a very famous but now forgotten American political scientist, who'd said that all the wars from the Napoleonic Wars onwards had been world wars because there were dominant conflicts about dominant ideas, dominant narratives, dominant norms of behavior. Who was going to define those? So if you're looking at the run-up to the First World War, you'll see that there was a narrative debate between Kultur and civilization, as the Germans called it, civilization being Anglo-American capitalism and Kultur being German culture. You couldn't get a bigger ideological divide than that. Power, there was a soft power. The Germans were very convinced that the English had soft power. They had none by virtue of the English language, because London was a world city and Berlin was considered to be provincial. And geopolitics, finally, that England was a world power and Germany was a European power, and hence the need by the Germans to build up Middle Europa and Europe and European integration to compensate for the fact, as Bismarck famously said, that Germany was too big for Europe, but too small for the world. And they were dealing with putative world powers like Russia, the United States, and indeed the United Kingdom at that time, the British Empire. So I think if we look back historically, I would say we are still in the era of dominant conflicts, that if George Lisker were alive today, this is exactly what he would be writing about. So yes, I mean, Oriana's point is very well taken, that we shouldn't be trapped by historical analogies. We shouldn't be trapped by historical analogies. But I fear Cold War is a historical analogy that actually applies to the world we live in.
Thank you very much, Christopher. Well, I'm one of the very few people who used to read George Lisker and actually got a great deal out of it. Obviously, you did yourself. Oriana, over to you.
Briefly. I listened to this discussion, and I want to agree and believe everything that everyone is saying. So these aren't really my viewpoints, but because we don't have someone from China on this panel, as someone who speaks Chinese and spends a lot of time there, I just want to highlight again that I think the viewpoint is very different from a number of things the speaker said. Like, for example, I know what the narrative is, right? China wants a different international system than the United States. But then there's a lot of evidence, Fareed Zakaria had that very interesting piece in Foreign Affairs that talked about how the United States has tried to overthrow 74 different countries, since the end of the Cold War, since the end of World War II, I think it was. I mean, how many wars have we fought? And I mentioned there's a lot of norms that we say exist that don't really exist. There's a lot of international regimes that, don't exist that should. We don't have agreements about, what should happen in cyber, what should happen in outer space. And so I think what we need to do is build this international system and build a consensus around it that we think currently exists. I don't think the international system is actually strong enough and that there is a consensus around that order. I would also say, since Graham Allison was brought up, I went and he asked me to give some comments on his book at Harvard when it first came out. And people worry about the war aspect, but if you look at all the cases, what's more concerning to me is whether peacefully or through war, rising powers overtook the great power like 85% of the time. It's very hard for great powers to stay in their position of power, whether through war or peacefully. And so, you know, we really do, if the United States and its allies and partners want to maintain this order, it's going to take a lot. And you know, thinking, yes, you know, China has done all these things that is more than asking countries, you know, don't talk about the Uyghurs, what have you, but it hasn't been enough of a threat. Even the statistics that show that European powers now have, you know, a worse view of China, they're not coming to fight with the United States if China attacks Taiwan tomorrow. Right, like no U.S. planner really expects the European powers to be on our side. And every couple of years, European countries still ask if they can sell weapons to China, right? So even within our context, I don't think the majority of the country, the majority of the world has seen China as the military threat, that the United States sees it and that a lot of countries in the region, as Jacob mentioned, that have, you know, territorial disputes, see China as. But we can't overstate sort of the... I don't want to be apologist in any way for the Chinese Communist Party, but this is not the Soviet Union, right? Mm-hmm. This is not North Korea. This is not a totalitarian regime. China doesn't have to build walls to keep people in. Like a lot of Chinese people want to go back. And you might say that, you know, people around the world are yearning to be free, but what does freedom mean? Right. I'm in Australia because, you know, I have a son with a respiratory condition and I couldn't leave my house for 5 months. And as long as Americans want to be free by not wearing masks, I'm not going home, right? So you have different types of freedoms. And I think what the Chinese would say is that economic freedom is also important and freedom for safety of yourself is also important. So I just want us to not be so optimistic that the way that we see the world is the way that everyone sees the world. And therefore we are destined to win this competition as long as, you know, we just get the narrative right. As long as we just, you know, highlight all these benefits to the rest of the world. I think fundamental change is also
happening. Thanks, Ariane. I've got lots of questions of my own, but I've also got 51 people lining up. I'll only make a comment. Don't try and answer it. As a student of the old Soviet Union, I was a Sovietologist, I confess here and now. One of the things that I think tended to happen throughout the whole period of the Cold War was a vast overestimation of the Soviet threat and a vast overestimation of Soviet power. Now, I know China's different, and I know it's got economic power and it's rich in the sense that the Soviet Union was not. It has multimillionaires and billionaires and has a large middle class. I know the differences. But I still wonder today, and this is only an observation and as a prelude to asking a few questions, whether or not we're making the same mistake again of maybe overestimating what we might call the China threat, whatever we think of the system, and whether or not this is also leading us into a deep security dilemma, which we can still avoid. I think, Jacob, you would say probably we're in that security dilemma. We can't get it. Anyway, I just want to throw that comment in because as a frustrated speaker, having to chair a meeting where I have to listen more than I speak, I just wanted to throw that one in terms of analogies. Anyway, I've got so many questions here. I'm going to start with an American question, Jacob, to you. I call it an American question because lots of people have asked me this one here. If Joe Biden wins, do you think that's going to lead to a big change in US policy towards China? I'll ask Jacob this one to kick us off, if that's okay. Jacob.
So Professor Cox, if I may, before jumping on that question, I just want to respond to three quick points. First being that I understand that China is not building walls to keep people in, but I think it's also important to ask ourselves, which Chinese are we asking? Are we asking members of the CCP in Beijing, or are we asking Tibetans or people in Hong Kong or people in Xinjiang? Last I checked, they have over 39 facilities that stretch across 150 soccer fields where they actually are building walls and cameras with facial recognition and engaging in forced sterilization.
If we can get to the question though, if you don't mind, Jacob. Sorry, I'll be a bit of a hard chair here, if you don't mind.
And it's okay, so with respect
to- Biden factor in China policy, yeah, thanks.
With respect to your question, what you're seeing today is that the Democratic Party is engaged in a big debate with itself between those that want to take the Democratic Party in a new and in a different direction, and those that, for lack of a better term, want to take the Democratic Party in a more restorationist approach, meaning dialing back the the policy approach to China back to the 2010s and late 2000s. That is the debate. I think it'll be hard to tell in the early years of the Biden administration where specifically the Biden administration will stand, because as you know, Vice President Biden has designated the Chinese government as a genocidal government that is committing genocide against its own people. And at the same time, there is a longstanding bipartisan tradition between dating back to the Bush years of delinking, called the dual track approach, where the United States engages, stands for, on principle for things like human rights, while at the same time engaging with governments that are perhaps adversarial, like the Soviet Union back in the day or China today, on big transnational issues. And I know that the Biden administration will seek to make progress on transnational threats, particularly like climate change.
Yeah, sure. Okay, fine. I'm going to bring one to you, Arnie, as a European, even though you're a Norwegian. I'll call you a European for the time being. People don't even call the Brits Europeans very soon, I'm gathering. Arnie, you've studied both America and China from the inside and from the outside. I know you spent a lot of time in China, and I spent some great times with you in China at Beijing. Do you think this is really about Trump and President Xi? In other words, to what extent, and this is an interesting question from Natasha Locke, thank you, Natasha, that in essence, take out President Trump, take out President Xi, you will have a rather different kind of relationship. What's your response to that, Arnie?
Well, I think leadership obviously matters, as we just talked about, the potential for a change in administration here in the United States. So I think this is a typical issue that you have to approach at two different levels. I mean, there are structural reasons why the United States and China have increasingly got into conflict with each other. And I laid those out at the beginning of our conversation. But of course, especially on the US side, with an administration that has been incapable of doing what is necessary to stand by its friends and allies in Eastern Asia, facing an increasing Chinese pressure, I do think that the personality and the policies of Donald Trump has led to China getting opportunities in terms of bringing pressure to bear on others. And I would concentrate it on the larger region, because that's where the issues really are at present. I think it's vital, if a new administration is coming in next year, that one starts to rebuild, reaffirm, and if possible, expand and deepen these security relationships and economic relationships with countries within the region. Because what I was referring to earlier on is that, you know, if that doesn't happen, this will indeed, in regional terms, as Oriana pointed out earlier on, be a power shift that happens much too quickly, that happens so quickly that I think it could lead to military conflict. The United States would find it very difficult simply to be a bystander. So yeah, personality matters, leadership matters, but unfortunately over the last 4 years on the US side, particularly in the negative.
Okay, I've got a question here for you, Christopher, because you've raised this both in your book and in your own comments. And we've got a number of people have asked the same question, inevitably. Cold War, but how about the possibility of a shooting war? Is the likelihood greater now than you wrote when you wrote your book? And what would be the immediate and specific cause? And even if it remains subnuclear, as of course Oriana said, and we certainly hope so, Oriana, nonetheless, what would be the specific area, the moment, the point, which would lead to a standoff, which is military, maybe doesn't escalate, but would be it? Christopher, over to you.
Well, Mick, perhaps two responses to that. First of all, I think the First World War broke out in very large measure because people thought it couldn't happen. And that's why I entitled my book The Improbable War, because if we'd been having this debate in 1912 about the possibility of a European war, all the intellectuals around the table would have said nonsense, you know, whether it was the editor of The Economist or the governor of the Bank of England, or it would have been Lloyd George, Chancellor of the Exchequer. They would all have said, and indeed did say, nonsense. It can't possibly happen. And that's where we were in that stage when I wrote the book. In fact, there was a meeting that you yourself took part in, I seem to recall, at the LSE, where we had some very famous American professors all saying wonderful things about how nice China was. And then I was the party pooper by saying, oh, by the way, I'm writing a book on the possibility of war between the United States and China. And they were shocked. And that was in 2013 or 2014. Now, of course, everyone is talking about it, and both countries are preparing for it. So we must get out of this terrible mentality of thinking that it can't happen, because it can. The second reason is, why do wars happen? They mostly happen because of accidents. They mostly happen because of unexpected confrontations, sometimes personalities. Obviously, the long-term consequence causes that historians are fascinated by ex post facto are there. But I think a war between the United States and China could happen over an incident at sea, very simply, or perhaps a satellite that is taken out by a missile, not necessarily direct, since anti-satellite warfare is what we're heading into, or a cyber attack on the United States. Or indeed a cyber attack on China that might be attributed rightly or wrongly to the other power. But my third and last conclusion is that war, it doesn't end. All these people who are writing books are the Steven Pinkers of this world, with their Enlightenment ideas about progress, et cetera, et cetera. War is the most protean activity of any activity that involves human beings. It changes and adapts and evolves. And now we're talking about hypersonic, we're talking about artificial intelligence, we're talking about cyber. And most importantly of all, to quote Lucas Kellow, the Oxford writer on cyber, we're talking about a period of unpeace. Now this is, I think, new in our history, where we cannot tell the difference between war and peace. Because we're already living in a state of war. As Jacob mentioned, the cyber attack on Australia was an act of war. But yet at the same time, of course, we're living in a period of peace. And it would be great if we could maintain this period of unpeace, if we have to, without it going hot. But at some point, there will be a miscalculation by one side or the other. And that's how great power wars usually erupt. Forget the Hitler analogy of somebody planning to have war. The Chinese aren't planning to have war any more than the Americans are planning to have war. But war is what we might get.
Just to follow up very quickly, Christopher, I don't want to extend this conversation, but I do think it's a very important point. Also, the United States gives guarantees to allies within the region. And if we look at the origins of wars, it is also about great powers giving guarantees. Other powers. One thinks of Britain and Belgium, Britain, France, and Poland, maybe even guarantees by the US to Eastern European countries through the ALTA. Would that be the most likely scenario, guarantees to allies within the region which might escalate?
No, absolutely, but you're dealing with two totally different countries here. And this is a big difference between the Soviet Union and the United States conflict. China doesn't do allies. It doesn't do alliances. I mean, Xi himself said this in the United Nations a couple of years ago. We do partnerships.
Yeah.
We don't have allies. We don't do expeditionary war either, he said. we do war in our own home turf. So I think we are dealing with two classically very different powers that think about war differently. And yes, the United States needs allies. It does expeditionary warfare. It needs bases because it can't do war in any other way, except through cyber and hypersonics, and so things are beginning to change. But I think this is a very important thing. And I think the Chinese policy is the Sun Tzu's policy of winning without firing a shot. And how does China win? By dismantling the American alliance system, little by little, buying countries off, making deals. Because if one day the United States wakes up to the fact that it has no alliances or allies in that area of the world, can it actually think of the war option? Probably not. Read Sun Tzu, as Kissinger says. This is the country that still reads Sun Tzu 2,000 years later. It's very different from the rest of us.
Well, read Sun Tzu and read Thucydides, and you might begin to understand China, I think. Oriana, I got a question for you. I'm trying to, you know, tailor some of the questions to what you've said. It's the inevitable COVID question, and the impact that one thinks COVID has had on the China-US relationship. And I suppose there's an implication here that in a sense, without putting it too crudely, and this is not the question that's asked, but I'll kind of put it in my own way. Has China come out of this COVID crisis, this human crisis of immense proportions, better than the United States? And how does that, in a sense, impact long-term on the relationship, and indeed domestically? I mean, has this reinforced President Xi at home? Over to you, Oriana. I'd be interested to hear your views on that.
Yeah, so I think the first thing when we say, does China and the United States, you know, do they come out better? One of the other reasons it's very hard to compete with China is we set different expectations for ourselves, and the international community then judges us in different ways, right? So for China, coming out of something like COVID, there's not going to be a lot of critiques or expectation about how they managed it. I mean, people can say that, but there's not a lot of transparency. We don't actually know, you know, how well people are doing. You're not going to have a lot of public critiques. And so the domestic politics of it, I think, you know, the United States, regardless of how we handled it, which was very poorly, you know, so that's also a problem. You know, China always comes out looking a little bit better than the United States does. Mm. In terms of how it's affecting things, I mean, I will say one of the big questions, piggybacking off of some of the things that Dr. Coker said, is about how it affects military readiness and military operations. There's this big question that comes up a lot, for example, as we've seen Chinese aggression on the border with India, as we've seen the pace and nature of military exercises over the summer increase in the South China Sea, people are asking whether, you know, does the reality matter? Or maybe does China see this as a window of opportunity? Do they see themselves as coming out better? And so now is the time to make some strides when it comes to their unfulfilled ambitions. I would say that this kind of misunderstands how the Chinese see the situation. I think one of the speakers mentioned all the wars that China has fought, at last one being 1979, when they were in a weaker position, which I think is very informative. But in a lot of cases, what ends up happening is that China has this view of deterrence in which they get fearful that other countries see them weak. And their view of deterrence is different than ours in the West. We think deterrence is the threat of force. The Chinese think it's so hard to make that threat credible. The best way to make it credible is just to use force. And so they see their actions, like on the border, these limited military activities, as ways of enhancing the credibility of their deterrent over those issues. And so that's what I see is happening during this COVID environment, is if you read, like Chinese are writing right now, they're very concerned, and I think actually genuinely concerned that President Trump is going to start a war with China, especially if the election is contested. So I think actually a lot of this aggression comes out of a position of weakness or fear of weakness. Now, the bad news is a lot of the aggression in the South China Sea also comes out of enhanced capabilities. So the bottom line is whether China feels weak or China feels strong, they're aggressive. So it doesn't really help us in the strategy sphere. And I'll just say, since I mentioned the South China Sea, in addition to something that was just said, I think it's problematic to think that this war is going to start accidentally. And I say that because China doesn't believe in accidental war. They don't believe in inadvertent escalation. They have these concepts of war control that says that those types of wars don't happen. Why would they fight a war that they don't think is beneficial to them? And I kind of agree with that assessment. A lot of what U.S. strategy has been is focused on this inadvertent problem. And I myself, while I'm obviously here in my civilian capacity, in my military capacity, have been a part of a lot of these mechanisms to try to enhance crisis management understanding. Those will all prevent, you know, inadvertent conflicts. But China is thinking about purposeful, deliberate uses of force. And if we only think war can start by accident, because who would want the costs of this major war, then we leave out, like, how do we, you know, deter and deal with this issue of China purposefully and deliberately fighting a war to their benefit.
Okay, great. That's good. I'm going to now move one question forward, and I'm going to bring you back in again, Jacob. When I studied the Cold War, one of the things I studied was not only the deeper causes of the conflict, but also how you managed it. And a large part of the Cold War wasn't about how you had the conflict. Everybody knew the causes. They thought they knew the causes of the conflict. How did you manage it in certain ways to de-escalate it, to manage it, and to keep it, quote unquote, cold? And the question to you, and this comes from quite a lot of listeners here, Jacob, which I think is a very interesting question. You've talked about the problems and the causes of the deeper conflict, and you've elaborated on those in great detail and very well. Are there any means and mechanisms that you could see of de-escalation means of managing the conflict in such a way that there could still be some benefits of the relationship as well as the costs of the conflict. And it goes back to Arne's question, what are we supposed to do now? You know, we can analyze this forever, but are there means and mechanisms we can think of de-escalation, not in a naive way of peace, I don't think anybody believes in that, but de-escalation to such a degree that we can still have a manageable relationship that doesn't unsettle the rest of the world, which it seems to be doing at the moment. Jacob, I'll pass that one over to you. That comes from a Chinese colleague as well as from me. Thanks, Jacob.
I think it is possible to de-escalate. I agree with Ariana that I actually believe the Chinese government is a very rational actor and it will engage in aggressive behavior if it thinks that it can get away with it. That's why I'm a profound believer in the value of deterrence. I think its deterrence will ultimately make it far more possible and likely to de-escalate on terms that will produce a sustainable peace over the long term. De-escalating unilaterally or in a way that's one-sided, I think will only invite a fait accompli move, for example, in the South China Sea, or another type of maneuver that will ultimately create a crisis where the United States has to choose between, do they step in to intervene in the defense of a place like Taiwan, or do they simply let it go? I think that, as Vice President Biden said, investing in the United States' sources of domestic renewal is ultimately a critical part of being able to de-escalate. And that might mean revisiting trading arrangements away from China in concert with allies like Japan, South Korea, which is home to Samsung, as well as Taiwan and other countries. So on the foreign side, I think deterrence is critical. And on the domestic side, I think making structural changes to invest in the domestic sources of strength, I think are gonna be indispensable elements.
Thanks, Jacob, great. Arne, I've got one for you now. You're a great student of the Third World. Your brilliant book on the Cold War was a global Cold War. And you made the very strong point there. Don't make it just the US, Soviet Union. Look at the rest of the world, where the Cold War was certainly not cold, as you well know from your studies of Central America, Southern Africa, and Asia. We've got a question here, Arne, though, about the Global South. The generic term, we don't know what term to use now, do we? We don't use the Third World any longer, so let's use the term Global South. Where does the Global South fit into all this? Because in a sense, we've been quite bipolar so far, if I might say, in our discussion, inevitably so given the topic. Where does the Global South fit into it? I mean, Africa, South America. Isn't China making great inroads into the Global South and challenging the United States and indeed the West there in the ways that it's been doing?
So I don't think that's the main trend that we are seeing at the moment. I mean, going back to what we discussed earlier on, I think we are more seeing, in many ways, a regionalization of the world with some retrenchment in terms of American power, but not a reciprocal growth in Chinese power. Obviously, China, because of its tremendous economic growth, is more economically influential on a global scale now than it was, say, 10, not to mention 20 years ago. But, you know, this goes back to the point about this not being primarily on a global scale, a bipolar conflict. So obviously, the rest of the world, including Europe, including the United States, should keep an eye on what China is doing with regard to its first and foremost economic strategies with regard to what we used to call the Third World. I have a suspicion that quite a few of these ventures, maybe especially in Africa, are going to end in tears from a Chinese perspective, because I don't think they have the necessary wherewithal, the necessary knowledge to explore these. I think, again, coming back to that point, Mick, what we should really be looking for is what is happening within the wider Eastern Asian region and perhaps throughout Asia overall, because that's the only region in which China has got a military, strategic, political, and economic strategy that actually goes together, and which will be under tremendous pressure over the next few years. And that was the point that was made by several of the speakers earlier on that I think is really important. So for the United States to recommit to balancing in that region with regard to the increase in Chinese strength will not be to put peace at risk. It will be the opposite. In the current situation, what that will mean is that we will have an opportunity, which we haven't had for the past 4 years, perhaps even a little bit longer than that, to actually influence what goes on in China, perhaps in a direction that there will be a new generation of Chinese leaders that will rethink their aims. Let me just finish on that point, Mick. One of the things that we haven't spent much time on discussing here, Oriana mentioned it briefly, are the sources of Chinese weakness. And there are some of those as well, right? Not least domestically, not least in terms of the Communist Party having staked all of its legitimacy on one main goal so far, which is continued economic growth. You know, as Kennan foresaw back in 1947 with the Soviet Union, you know, it can happen very quickly in a state that is completely dependent on one party's power, that it goes from being seen as a rising state to be seen as a failing state, as we saw in the case of the Soviet Union and Russia. So we have to think about that perspective with regard to China as well. That's the reason, I think, why we need to be very, very concerning in terms of the kind of aims that we have for working with other countries within the region, to be prepared for all eventualities, because a decline in China could be as difficult to handle in a regional sense as a result.
Which actually leads to a very big question, which a number of people have asked, and I'm going to kind of, I say this is really going to be the last question, because I think it's going to take up a little bit of time. We think of the Cold War, but we haven't talked about the end of the Cold War. One side lost, putting it rather crudely. It wasn't a draw. You know, it wasn't maybe, maybe not. It was a win for one side, however you explain how it happened. And it's a win for one side, and finally the Soviet Union itself disintegrated and collapsed. And that, in a sense, gets to your point, Arnie. If we're talking of analogies and parallels between the Cold War, can we talk of parallels of the end of the Cold War? And we all know that China has been obsessed, and I found this out through your work, Arnie, and being in China with you, how China is so obsessed by what happened to the old Soviet Union and why they're going to make every effort, political, economic, and cultural, and ideological, to make sure it doesn't happen to them. So I suppose the question is, and it segues on the back of yours, is that really the historical analogy we should also be thinking about? And you kind of touched on it, Arnie. Don't think about China's rising, the big power transition, a la Thucydides and Graham Allison and all sorts of other people, but maybe think of what are those fundamental weaknesses within the system of which the Chinese leadership may be well aware and having to deal with that. And who will come out best, if I can put it in those terms? And one of the other questions came in is, doesn't the United States really have so many more cards to play in the end, whether economic, ideological alliances and the rest, that it should be feeling a lot more confident about this relationship, and China should be feeling a lot less confident about it? So what I'm going to do, I'll pass that question over firstly to Christopher, come on to Jacob, and then come back to you lastly, Arnie. So Christopher, one side lost, can the same thing happen this time around, rather than it ending in war?
Well, if it doesn't end in war, I don't really see the collapse of one society or another. I think Americans who hope to see the implosion of China and the collapse of the Communist Party in China are probably going to be still studying this in 200 years' time. Dynasties come and go, and China is very resilient. So the debate in China is about returning to the natural order of things, where China was the number one power in the world, without the rest of the world knowing it, for 700 or 800 years. And the other question for the United States is how long can America remain the hegemonic, if it's still a hegemonic power? I mean, it's been the largest economy since 1869, and it's still today the largest economy, but we know that is going to come to an end quite soon. It will be the number two economy. But will it remain the number one global actor, which is what you were, I think, referring to? I think these are the two narratives. And we just have to keep looking at this space. I don't think it's an existential struggle in the way that the United States and the Soviet Union thought it. You remember Better Dead Than Red? It doesn't get more existential than that. You know, telling people in the 1950s, it's better to die in a nuclear war than become communist. Or whatever the Russians were saying, a similar type of story, but perhaps with different terms. It's not an existential struggle. It's a struggle for power.
Although remember, Christopher, if I might add, a few years later, Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev was in America talking about kitchens, with Richard Nixon. So it also evolved over time as well. But I take your point. Jacob, end of the Cold War analogies, not just analogies with the Cold War, but analogies with the end of the Cold War, that one side could actually implode. Chris was quite skeptical about that. What about you? What do you think on that one?
I'm very skeptical that there will be a similar precipitous type of implosion that we saw in the late 80s and early 90s in the Soviet Union. For the same reasons that a lot of speakers on this panel articulated, China is just so different internally than the Soviet Union was. With that being said, I do think that we are just in the very early stages of this geopolitical standoff, and therefore, while it remains to be proven whether the conclusion of this contest will happen within our lifetimes, it may very well not, there may come a day when structural changes, whether it's on the American side or on the Chinese side, do happen, because I do believe that ultimately the United States and China have fundamentally contradictory objectives for how they want to order the world. And democracy, in the grand scheme of things, is a relatively new concept. Somebody brought up just the incredibly long history that China's had and returning into the natural order of things. America's been around for under 300 years and China's been around for 5,000 years. It's not necessarily true that China will always remain under the grip of the CCP. By the same token, we don't know, and we shouldn't take for granted the fact that democracies will always been around, will always be around. They haven't been around for most of European history, and the United States is still a very new country, and I think that that's also something we should take for granted.
Thanks. Ariana, over to you. Is there an end point to this, which actually could be like the Soviet Union or not? What do you think? It's a very speculative question, but it's worth reflecting on, because nobody thought the Soviet Union was going to go under either.
Right. And so our cognitive biases prevented us from seeing the Soviet Union go under. So I think a lot of people now look at history and then they assume that those things are going to happen. Now, in this conversation, it seems like these panelists, you know, are much more clear-eyed about this. But I will say in the United States, there's constantly this discussion or this assumption, right, that it cannot last, right, that the Soviet Union went under and so will China. China, actually, the CCP no longer relies on economic growth as its main form of political legitimacy. I mean, that was the case, you know, maybe 20 years ago, but now it really is this road to national rejuvenation, which is about being able to protect yourselves from foreign powers because of China's history. Now, we might say these tensions just began, but the Chinese have been actively competing with the United States now for 70 years. Like in their view, this is, you know, at least 70 years, this has been kind of the plan. And just to bring it back to the domestic politics, I mean, one of the reasons I highlight, you know, that China isn't a totalitarian regime. And of course, there are people in China whose lives are a lot worse under the CCP than they would be otherwise. But there are a lot of Chinese people that are really authentically nationalistic, right? That are like love Xi Jinping because, you know, they'll whisper on the streets that Hu Jintao never stood up for them. But now Xi Jinping, you know, the second a foreign country wants to bully China, they no longer bully China. And so a lot of times we have these assumptions, at least in the United States, I've heard people say like, oh, like, let's just say there's a conflict, you know, that maybe China will also have to deal with domestic instability. Maybe like the Chinese people will take to the streets to like, you know, use this as a window of opportunity or something. But the Chinese people, if they are on the streets in a Taiwan contingency, they are on the streets to support their country, to support that government. And so I worry that if we have these assumptions for many years in the United States, we did not think strategically because we were hoping the problem would solve itself, that China would just go away from its, you know, own issues, right? Like banks came into China, surely they'll collapse. Like they allowed prices to fluctuate, surely they'll collapse. You know, they entered the WTO, surely they'll collapse. Now they have these debt issues of Corona, surely they'll collapse. I'm not an economist, so I can't say whether that will happen, but I will say as a military strategist, I'd rather prepare for the situation. Not that we're fighting a weak China that is using war as a distraction, but we're fighting a China that is strong, that has the full support of its people behind it in whatever military operation they're under.
Yeah. I'm going to bring Arnie in very briefly, Arnie, because I think you and I agree on this particular one, but you were the one who said to me, Chinese were when we were teaching together, they're very obsessed by what happened to the Soviet Union. And perhaps one of the reasons that it's going to survive is because they drew the right lessons from what happened to the former Soviet Union as well, Arnie.
They've certainly drawn lessons from it, Mike.
Well, I mean,
that will be in the longer run. I don't know. Look, CCP power is not going to be around forever in China. What will replace it will certainly be just as nationalist, if not more nationalist, than what CCP is. So we have to forget about the idea that everything will necessarily be better. If there is some kind of political crisis that hit the Chinese Communist Party midship, I think what we first and foremost need to look at is what has happened now over the last decade, when China seems to be doing pretty well under CCP rule, as Oriana said, for most Chinese. I lived in Beijing for 6 months last year, and it was really striking to see how the party has been building its legitimacy based on the twin towers of nationalism and economic progress. While the image of the West, because of our actions, not their actions, in Europe and in the United States, have been a view of decline, right, of chaos. And that's the challenge at the moment. So before we start talking about, you know, what might happen on the Chinese side, we should be asking ourselves, are we capable economically and politically of the kind of restructuring that is necessary to compete effectively with China?
Yeah, thanks, Arnie. Well, I'm going to bring this wonderful discussion and of all four speakers to a conclusion. I've got a couple of quick business things to do. There's a short feedback form that will appear in your browser when this event ends. We'd be grateful if you could take 1 minute to tell us what you thought of the event. Thank you. I'm reading it out there, so make sure I get it word perfect. That's good. 15 years ago, a young Arnie Westad and a young Professor Cox got together at the LSE when we both arrived there, or I'd arrived a little later. And we said, well, what a good idea to set up a Cold War study center. I think at the time, a lot of people thought we were a bit crazy, Arnie, because they thought, well, the Cold War's over. But as we've discovered in this discussion, we may not know what to define the US-China relationship, but the analogy still holds. However, even if the Cold War is or is not on, whatever, however we define it, the Cold War Study Center segued into LSE ideas. Arnie and I ran that for many years before Arnie took the boat to the United States. And I think this evening's event, I think, is at least a good investment of our time and effort and friendship. Then and now, Arnie, what we actually created. And I think it says a lot for how well we built and how well Christopher and others will take LSE ideas forward. I'd like to say a very special thank you to Oriana down in Australia, to Jacob. I think you're in Stanford at the moment, Jacob, I assume, for coming onto this program and giving us your expertise and different points of view, because that's precisely what we want to encourage here. Again, thank you to Christopher, who will has taken over the leadership of LSE Ideas. And last but not least, thank you to all those who've helped organize this. Thank you to all the people out there who've asked so many questions, such a large audience. And again, have a very good evening, good morning, or good afternoon. And do join us again at LSE Ideas, because we've got many more webinars and discussions to come. So thanks again, Jacob, Oriana, Arnie, and Christopher. Goodbye, everybody.